Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to the Coaching Call podcast. On this podcast, we'll cover various types of coaching by trainers in sports, martial arts, fitness, and business. We'll discuss each coach's methods to getting the most out of their respective athletes or clients and how they attempt to change the platform in which they coach. Join us on a fun adventure as we discuss unique coaching styles. We've all been coached before, in school, at work, or on a team. Your first coaches were your mom and dad, who taught you how to communicate, tie your shoes, or play a simple game of catch. Coaching is a universal part of how we get others to get something done. Join your host, Rafael, and his guests on this unique journey in coaching.
Hi, I'm Sifu Rafael, and this is the Coaching Call podcast. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe and leave a review. This episode was made possible by listeners like you. If you enjoy my show, go ahead and buy me a cup of coffee. Make it a large. To donate, go to paypal.me/SifuRafael. That's SifuRafael. I'm trying to keep this podcast free of advertisements. Anything you can donate is greatly appreciated. Thank you.
In that, I found something within myself, a layer of inspiration and a layer of spiritual and psychological depth that I didn't know was there, that I never had a way to access before that.
My guest today is Mike Harris. Mike is a performance mastery coach and adventurer. As a coach, he works with top executives, founders, professional athletes, and performing artists in support of their highest level of performance. Mike, thank you so much for joining me on Coaching Call. How are you today?
I am wonderful, Raphael. How are you doing today?
Amazing. So you're a performance mastery coach. What does that mean?
Yes, sir. What that really means to me is I coach individuals, whether they be executive CEOs, founders, athletes, performing artists. I coach them around the inner game of greatness. Nice. We have the thoughts and understandings that directly drive our performance, and we have those that lie a layer underneath, and it's that layer where we really create magic together.
So, I mean, you didn't become that kind of coach overnight. Something had to have happened, right? So let's go back to your childhood. When we think about everything that we are doing today, there had to be someone, something that impacted our lives and drove us in the direction we're going. And sometimes people go in all different directions until they actually find their purpose, their calling. Tell me what or how is it growing up and who influenced?
Yeah, growing up was a fascinating experience in this learning to deal with tension. I grew up in a very tense house, and I never really got why things were tense. I was a happy kid.
Right.
And I never had the idea that limitation was a thing. I never got that. People told me about it. People were happy to tell me all about limitation all the time. But I just wasn't hearing it. And my dad, I think he was sort of the same way. He kind of smushed it down. But I got that from him a little bit, where he would really go deep into details to figure out problems with things when he was out in his workshop working on things. And he was an engineer by trade, and he would go far and wide to figure out some innovative way to fix something or to make something work for him. And in that, I always got the sense that we can do that anywhere. And I didn't really get the psychological layer of that at that time, but I kind of got that there was that possibility that we weren't as limited as we thought we were.
And so tell me, when you say it was limiting beliefs, and everybody kept telling you about it, but like you and your dad, you guys were like, no, this is not for real. This is not really what it is, right?
Yeah.
Who influenced you besides your dad when you were a little kid? How was growing up? You had siblings? Did you have uphill both ways to school? You know, all that kind of stuff.
No, so growing up, I lived the first 10 years of my life in a town called Willingboro, New Jersey, which is about 10 miles away from Philadelphia. And it was a kind of, I would kind of call it like a blue collar, hard scrabble, middle class town. Nobody in our neighborhood was broke or anything like that. But it was like people worked hard and kind of lived hard lives. Mm. I had two sisters and a brother. I'm by far the youngest. I'm 10 years younger than my next youngest sister. And so in some ways I was an only child. And then when I was seven, I kind of became a middle child when my oldest sister started having kids and my parents became grandparents, which every grandparent will tell you being a grandparent sees way better than being a parent.
Right, of course. You don't have the headaches.
Yeah, you can give them back.
Yes.
So growing up there was a little tough. It was a tough neighborhood, and I wasn't really a tough kid. Hmm. And so I got picked on, bullied. I was this round little thing with Coke bottle glasses, and my saving grace was baseball. Was that I had pretty much all you can eat baseball in my yard. I had all the pitchback things where I could pitch to myself and places where I could hit balls around. And that was really a miracle in my life that I had that. And then when I was 10, we moved to a different town called Evesham, New Jersey, and little more upper middle class. And I struggled a lot there because everyone was smarter. Maybe they had a little more of a sense of entitlement from having had a little more success in life. And I thought that I had it tough in Willingboro. And boy, did I wish at times that I could go back, because it was nobody was beating on me, but they were getting in my head a lot. They were toying with my thoughts, and I didn't know what to do about that. And when I was in high school, I started to learn how to work through that thanks to some of my football coaches. I was a big boy and gave up baseball for football when I was 13, 14. Right. And I had one particularly inspiring coach, Coach Dietz. He would read us poems. And I would always think, what the hell is this guy doing reading us a poem? We got to go out and play ball. We got to go bash heads. But I mean, this man would read us Invictus. This man would read us Rudyard Kipling, people who were really, really inspiring to my 14, 15, 16 year old self. And in that, I found something within myself, a layer of inspiration and a layer of spiritual and psychological depth that I didn't know was there, that I never had a way to access before that.
That's high school. What happened after high school?
What happened after high school? Well, limitations became more of a presence in my life. I graduated high school young. I graduated when I was 16. I got my driver's license. Here in Jersey, we get our licenses at 17. I got mine 2 weeks before I was supposed to go off to school. My folks didn't want me going away to school. They said it was a waste of money, and they sent me to a community college. I wasn't happy about that, but I went, and then I performed there exactly like I was not happy about it. I bounced in and out of school for better than a decade.
Long time.
I flunked out three times. I flunked out of three different community colleges, which is funny. I was one of those kids in elementary school and middle school in the academically gifted classes. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't, but I didn't feel like putting forth the effort anymore. And it was around that time I was 17. I had my driver's license. I discovered the miracle of pool halls.
Now let's talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I roamed into a pool hall one night, probably 11:30 at night after taking my girlfriend home. And I just wanted to be alone for some reason. I roamed into this place that was open till 5 in the morning, got a rack of balls, got a table and hit balls around for an hour. And a couple tables over, there was this young looking but bald guy who was making everything in sight, playing perfectly, playing beautifully. And I could see that there was something different, not just that he was playing well, but I saw a crispness in the movement of the ball. I thought that I was just captured by that. I was absolutely captured by it. And I started going back, trying to find that for myself. And I would go back 3-4 nights a week. At that time, I was working part-time at a Kmart or a Walmart or something like that. And I was pretty much spending my whole paycheck at the pool hall. And one night, the owner of the room saw me playing in the corner and came over to me and decided to show me a few things. And it turned out he'd been a professional 20 years before.
Wow.
And he said, you do these things, and you'll start to get better. And I did. And I spent maybe 5 years on that plateau where I was getting a little better. I was getting incrementally better. And then I would snap back. I would go back to where I was before, maybe even a little worse. And it always felt like 2 steps forward, 2.5 steps back. Right. And 5 years later, I finally started paying for lessons from that bald man that I saw the first night I was in the pool room.
Your coach.
That was the first time I'd been coached.
That's the first time you paid for coaching.
Yes.
Because you had previous coaches, but they were part of your academia, right?
Correct. Yes.
This is the first time you actually said, I value, not because it's part of my schooling, but it's something outside where I actually have to take my own money and pay someone else to make me better.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's a great distinction.
You understood the difference of what a real coach is. I mean, don't get me wrong, your football coaches are real coaches, but this is someone where they're going to elevate you on a specific topic because you're investing in
it. Yeah, absolutely correct. And I spent about 6 months working with him. And in 6 months, I reached the point where he said, I don't have anything left to teach you. It's up to you to do what you need to do with this. And his incredible piece of parting advice was, take in every resource you can find if you really want to get better at this. Take in every resource you can get your hands on. You'll figure out what's good and what's not as you go. I did that. And damn if it didn't work. I took some chances.
You have to.
Some of them were monetary. Mm-hmm. I invested a significant amount of money in another coach who taught me how to practice systematically and how to track my practice, how to modify my practice. I spent 3 hours on the phone one day paying no money for a conversation with a man who completely transformed my game without me ever even looking at a pool table.
Mindset.
And there was mindset and there was knowledge disseminated in a way that required more of my presence. I called him on the phone. The man's name was Hal Hull. He was based out of San Francisco, and he'd been a traveling exhibition player in the 1940s and 1950s. At this point, he was about 80 years old, and I'd heard incredible things about him. He asked me, he said, are you at a pool table right now? I said, no, I don't have one in my apartment. He said, okay, what do you have nearby? I said, I have a tile top kitchen table. He said, that's perfect. Let's get to work. And he taught me some geometric tools that I could use to better pocket balls. And he described it to me in a way that was not just crystal clear, but like I said, required me to translate what I was seeing, translate what I was creating on this tile top table, to translate it to something more real, something more applicable. That became a theme throughout every bit of coaching I've ever done.
Wow. That's a huge impact on your life, huh?
Unforgettable, as you can see.
Oh, yeah. One of the things and about me, I love pool. And when I was a kid, probably 11, my sister I lived with my sister, had a pool table in the basement. Mm. So I started picking it up. And then I got, back in the day, it was VHS tapes. And I started watching, you know, you go to the library and you can pick up some tapes or books, you know, Fats Domino. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Amazing stuff. And so I wanted to learn all these parlor tricks, right? So I started doing all that. I think by the age I was 13, maybe 12, 13, I was a little pool shark. So I would have my friends come over and I would bet them a quarter per game, right? And after a while, I just have a bunch of quarters. And then one kid, I think he's like, let it ride, let it ride, let it ride. And at this point, I think it was $7. And I said, okay, it's my turn to break. And so I said, no, you owe me about $7. He goes, let it ride. He goes, you know what? Double it. He goes, if you win, $14. If I win, I get all my money back. And you owe me $7. I said, okay. And to my surprise, on the break, I won. Because we were playing 8-ball. On the break, I won. And he was like, what? He couldn't believe it. So then he didn't want to play me anymore. But what wound up happening is that I would practice for hours and hours like you did. And, you know, I don't play anymore and I miss it. But every so often I do go to a pool hall and I just pick it up. But then what wound up happening is I started taking my money and I started investing in pool sticks. You know, the ones that you take apart. Because when I used to go to pool halls, you see the really good guys playing in the corner, right? And they would be competing and they would have chairs up higher so you can see them. And I'd always be like, oh, those guys doing. And then they would always come out with their beautiful cases and put their sticks together. And I was like, that's what I want. So my first thing I wanted to do was buy a pool stick. Mm-hmm. Right. So I bought one of the ones that you could put together. I still have it, which is pretty, it's in my closet. I still have it. And it's just so fun. So I learned that for me, sometimes going over the other side of the table, I had to really reach and I didn't like that. So I decided I'm going to learn how to play lefty as well. So I went from lefty to righty, and that definitely, I didn't get professional like you, but I just had a blast with it. And I used to go to a place when I used to work in the city. I used to do interior design architecture. So at lunchtime, I used to go to a local billiard hall and play nine ball. I used to play nine ball with a lot of guys, and it was so much fun. They're like, you should join the competition. I'm like, yeah, I don't have time. I don't have time for that. But I'm here at lunchtime. So every lunch, if I wasn't at a restaurant eating, I was playing live during my lunchtime. So it was
nice. What was the pool hall you were going to?
So long ago. It was on 4th Street in the Village. It was in the Village.
Okay. It wasn't one of the Amsterdams, was it?
I don't even recall. It's been so many years ago.
No.
And it was, no, it was around 20, it was on 19th Street. It used to be like 18th, 17th Street, something like that, in the Village, in the East Side.
Okay.
But I've worked in so many different architectural firms. Anytime I can find a pool hall, I used to go to it. So much fun. So much fun.
Nice.
But wait a minute. You did not stop there. You're also a professional poker player. So
yeah,
that's very interesting, because now we're talking number. We're talking math. We're talking fast, fast, fast. You have to be fast and you have to have a game face.
A little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk to us about that. That's got to be very, very interesting.
So at that point in my life, it was about 2003, and I was bartending. Mm-hmm. And I was bartending at a chain restaurant and cleaning up one night, and the World Series of Poker was on the TV on ESPN. And this was right around the time the poker boom was happening. Mm-hmm. And Chris Moneymaker won the main event. And what a better story than that? The guy who wins the world championship is named Moneymaker. And he's this regular guy from Tennessee who was an accountant. And I'm watching this as I'm cleaning up. These guys are wearing sunglasses inside, trash talking each other like crazy, and right, slinging around hundreds of thousands of dollars with absolutely no respect whatsoever for it. And I thought, I would like to do that for a living. I'm going to do that.
Right.
And so I took what I learned from my instructor, Scott Freeman, the man who told me to take in every bit of information I could. And I started doing that with poker. I bought all the books I could, and I would read them on my break at work. And at this point, I was dead broke, and I was in a lot of debt. I was struggling a lot financially and emotionally at that time in my life. And I would put in whatever money I could to play online. Right. I would put, whether it was, you know, $20, $50, $100, whatever I could do. And every time I would run it up a little bit and then lose it all, run it up again and make a dumb mistake and lose it all. And it took a lot of practice to develop the discipline to not make those silly mistakes, to understand where I needed to exercise more discretion than I had been. Within about a year, I had become a full-time working pro. By that point, I'd probably played 100,000 hands of poker.
Wow.
I would play multiple hands or multiple tables at the same time online. And where I live is about an hour from Atlantic City, New Jersey. So I have the luxury of being able to take a short drive and play people in person. So learning the math was relatively easy, as it turns out, because it's pretty simple sets of numbers. It's very straightforward. We're always dividing by doing some divisible of 52 or 51 or something like that, however many cards are left to be dealt. And it's a matter of knowing what hand you have and what hand you're playing for and what hand you are looking at in your opponent as well.
Right.
And that's where the nuance of the game is. Mm-hmm. And some things I learned. You mentioned having a game face. As it turns out, everybody knows about that. Everybody knows about the poker face. So everybody is really working hard to like really keep their facial expression good and tight, concealed as much as possible. And had to learn to look other places if I wanted to find out some extra information if I felt like I needed it. Mm-hmm. So rather than look at someone's face, if I could see their neck, that's a bonus. Because if someone is, especially if someone's thin, you have a decent chance of seeing an acceleration or increase in their pulse, in their neck, if they're excited about something. Also, looking at their shoulders is helpful, because you'll notice when someone's feeling confident about something, they'll straighten up, their shoulders will essentially level out. When they're feeling a little less confident about something, you'll notice a little slump. Nobody slumps uniformly, typically. They typically slump to one side or the other habitually for whatever reason, probably because we're used to sitting at desks now.
Right.
But they will usually slump to one side or the other. One of their obliques will just weaken just enough so that a shoulder dips. Those are the places I started looking for. I didn't really want to get into the idea that this is like the movie Rounders and we're letting Teddy KGB open up the Oreo. And like, that's too precise.
Right.
That's too precise. That's too niche.
Mike, you became very detail oriented then, right? And you learned how to read body language.
Yeah.
In order to benefit you, obviously. How has that impacted your coaching career now?
That's a great question. Well, now, especially in a group, if I have a group of people working together, I can tell, say, if I'm working with one individual and I notice someone else in the group, their posture has changed. I can get a sense of how people are feeling about what's going on, whether someone else has something that needs to be addressed, whether it's in the moment or in a subsequent conversation. It's the ability to notice what's triggered by what's happening. You know, I'm having this interaction over here, what that triggers in the rest of the group, and how we can deal with that. Is that a group dynamic thing to be figured out? Is it some individual attention that's required? So it's really helpful in that way. It's also helpful simply working one-on-one with a client, because especially if we're in person in our natural habitat, our natural habitat as individuals for us is a powerful place, because it's the place we always are able to lie. We're always able to not tell the truth about something in our natural habitat, because we've learned how to do that there. We've learned how to be dishonest with ourselves there. So if I can notice a shift in body language that belies what they are saying to me, now I've got something to address. I've got a powerful tool at my disposal where I can say, hey, I noticed, you know, you said this and your body language said this. What's going on there?
Where's the truth?
Yeah. And it also led me to take another direction in how I work with people, where I like to take my clients on hikes. Typically, if it's someone who is not doing their work in nature, this is a major change in habitat for them. And I live by the saying with that, no new behavior shows up on the mountain. We will not do something that is inconsistent with our subconscious behavior on that mountain. I can become a different person on the mountain. So that's a great template for getting really increased overt information. Whereas, you know, the body language that's not consistent with the words, that's a little more covert. We're going to see more overt information out of the natural habitat.
Because they're not in their comfort zone.
Yeah.
So high wire, make them walk a high wire, a tight wire. I'm just kidding. And then ask questions. When we think about everything you've done, all your different experiences, and when you bring them together, I think that's what's making you such a great coach. And one of the other things that you've been studying is, and this is what I'm reading, is that you've been studying the risk and the resilience, right? What is the difference between someone who is willing to take the risk and the resilience that they're going to put forth in that taking that risk?
Yeah. So when we take a big risk, it's an act of trust.
That is.
And we're not trusting the outcome necessarily, right? Sometimes that is the case. And that's a formula for requiring a lot of resilience, because you're not just overcoming. If, say, you know, you take this risk with the idea that the outcome is going to be, you make $100,000, right? Say we're risking some money invested in a business, and the outcome is that we're going to make $100,000, and we lose money. But we were so focused on that, oh, well, this is going to happen. We're going to make $100,000. And we not acknowledge the risk of what we might lose. When we do that, we're setting ourselves up for requiring double the resilience, because not only do we have to be resilient from the outcome, the loss incurred, also have to exercise some resilience around the disappointment the extra disappointment from this surprising, this somehow surprising failure. So taking a risk is an act of trust, and taking a risk intelligently is understanding that resilience will likely be required. So a few distinctions I like to add in there is that, one, resilience isn't just when something major happens. Resilience isn't just for major events. I'm talking about micro resilience here. Resilience from the little day-to-day struggles. Right. That's having that resilience is essential, and being able to practice that on a day-to-day basis requires that you have people who get it, surrounding you, who are able to support you through that, right? Not people who are going to commiserate in the failure or necessarily try to fix it for you. People who are there to listen, to support you in whatever way you need, and help you dust yourself off and get back on your feet.
Someone who's not going to praise you because you tried, instead of trying to tell you, you tried, but that's not good enough. You got to do better, right? That's what you're looking
for. Right.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
When we think about risk, right, I think the greatest part of us really comes out when we risk, when we go for it. We should understand, and you talked about resilience, we should understand that with everything we do, there's always a chance we may fail. But we can't live in that I'm going to fail mindset. We actually have to work in the mindset of, I'm going to do this and I know it's a risk. I may fail, but that's not really what I'm going to look at. I'm going to look at the opportunities that are going to present themselves if I take this risk. Because if I don't take this risk, I'm not going to gain anything. I'm not going to be able to advance whatever it is I'm looking to advance, whether it's finances, business, relationships, anything like that. So risk to me means get off your butt, do what you have to do, right? And you know what? It's okay to fail. Just try it again. Get back up. Do it again. And that, I think, is what you're talking about, resilience, right? It's okay to fail. Learn from it. Move on. And guess what? You're going to fail again. And you're going to fail today, and you're going to fail tomorrow. You have to understand that these are parts of growing. This is everything that's going to make you amazing. How do you help someone who comes to you and maybe someone else pushed them toward you, but they have that resistance of, I can do it on my own, doing the work that they need to be doing in order to facilitate that growth. And someone just keeps pushing them to you. Finally, they kind of give in. They're like, yeah, okay, whatever. I'll go talk to Mike. How do you help someone like that?
The two things I do is, one, I give them the raw truth.
That's important.
About what they've been doing and what needs to be done. And number two, I don't push them to work with me. Sometimes the best thing that can happen for us is that we stew in our own juices. I know that's been a transformative experience for me. I know that I have gone through a lot of things where I have had to experience the suffering before understanding how much I needed help. There is something profoundly transformative about it if you're open to the experience. And people who are open to that experience are typically going to be open to the experience of being supported and using coaching to create the changes that they desire in their life.
I agree with you 100%. Because if they don't want the coaching and they're not even slightly bit open, you're going to be spinning wheels, like spinning plates.
Yeah.
Look, for anybody who's spinning plates, that's all they can do. They can't do anything else.
Right. 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 It's, once we get out of the habit of spinning plates and fighting fires, we can start to make some fundamental changes. Until then, we're just going to keep running around with a plate spinner on one hand and a fire extinguisher in the other.
And that's it. You only have two hands.
That's right. I'll tell you what, if you can use your feet for any of those things, you've got a special skill set and you need to be putting that to use.
Now you're a performer. When we think about peak performance, how do we get someone from being your average performer to becoming a peak performer?
From being an average performer to a peak performer, we are looking at two changes. We're looking at two fundamental shifts. One is finding and creating the fundamental practices, the major things that will elevate their performance. So whether that is a practice around communication for an executive or a founder, or whether that is something physical or a mental thing for an athlete, something to a mental process to go through before performing. The other thing is the deep mindset, like we alluded to earlier, the layers that are underneath that, right? We have our decision making, and then we have thoughts underneath that drive the decision making, the thoughts that will essentially override any decision making process that we have, will override that in the moment. So it's exploring that, looking at what's helpful, what's not, and what needs to change.
When we think about everything you just said, it definitely has to be for someone who is willing to sacrifice, right? To become a peak performer.
It is hard work.
You have to sacrifice. You do. I mean, no matter what.
Yeah.
Listen, you want to be better at work, you're going to have to sacrifice maybe your Friday nights or your weekend getting drunk or who knows what, right? You have to actually put the work in. You may have to even sacrifice a little bit of family time in order to achieve something. But then you also have to somehow fight hard enough to find that balance where you are, if you have a family, be there for them. So you don't have regrets later on that I was not there for my kids. So it's a very tough thing for anyone to really do. And I think that's why having the right coach like yourself is a critical aspect of leveling up, moving on, and following and pursuing our dreams. Because, having dreams is great. Pursuing them is also great. Having a plan, that's the real key. And acting on that plan, holy cow, does that change everything, right? But like I said, you have to sacrifice. And if you're not willing to sacrifice, things won't change. Look, I had someone who came to me and they wanted to quit smoking. And so I talked to them, how long you've been smoking, the whole deal. And I said, okay, how are you? Are you ready to do so? I said, okay. For every cigarette that you light up, I want you to take another one and throw it away. Every time you light one up, you have to throw one out. How many packs do you smoke a day? One. I said, okay. Guess what? You're going to wind up, if you do everything I'm telling you, you're going to only smoke half a pack a day. And you're going to want, because you can't buy another one. You can't buy two packs. And in 2 days, you would have smoked what you used to smoke in one. And we keep doing that until you slowly, as long as you're making the sacrifice, as long as you're willing to throw that cigarette away, then you're going to make that change. It's going to be habitual. And that's the problem people have, also changing habits. I tell everybody, look, if a habit is hard to break, it's because you're not willing to change. You're not willing to break that habit, right? So it is a sacrifice. One of the things I do is I always change everything. So this way, nothing is in control of me. I am in control. So I have no habits that I say, I have to do this or I have to eat this type of food. No, I change it up. I'm Colombian. I love coffee. But guess what? A couple of days, I'm like, I'm not having coffee. Why? Because coffee doesn't control me. Right?
Yeah.
About 2 months ago, I said, I realize I always put my right shoe on first. I'm going to start doing my left. So I said, that's just controlling the mind to be in control. Right? If we can change that little bit of a habit, we can change everything. We can make those sacrifices. When someone offered me a cookie the other day, I said, and I love cookies. I said, well, I said, thanks. Really? You sure? Oh, positive. How about, no, I'm good. I could have eaten that cookie, right?
Yeah.
Because, hey, I love cookies. But I chose not to allow me to make the wrong choices for me, right? Because we get in our own way. And that's what
Oh, totally.
That's where bad habits come in.
Right. And there's another kind of sacrifice that lies underneath this that's really essential here. And that is we have the sacrifice of logistics, right? Mm. Spend maybe giving up a Friday night or a weekend for work. A lot of my clients are also that's the easy part of sacrifice for them. But when we get into sacrificing one's image or one's reputation in service of improvement. Now, that really goes back to the example as well of, your client who wanted to quit smoking. A lot of people I know who try to quit smoking, they do okay without the nicotine. They're okay with weaning off of it. It's the part about not being a smoker anymore that they struggle with, right? And if you're an executive who got to that position by being hard driving and uncompromising and rough around the edges, and that's how you communicate, and now all of a sudden it's not working anymore, are you willing to let go of that in service of creating better culture for your team, better performance for yourself and for your team? Are you willing to sacrifice that? because, and those are the hard sacrifices to make.
Absolutely.
Because they fundamentally get at who we think we are. And then you go up a level. If we're talking going from, you said from average to peak, if we're talking about getting to the elite levels of performance, the top 1% of 1% of 1%, we are no longer talking about what are you willing to sacrifice alone. Mm-hmm. We're also talking about what are you willing to lose? Oh, yeah. Because there are things that we're going to consciously sacrifice. We're going to offer up to the performance gods. We're going to say, I sacrifice this image of mine. I sacrifice these cookies. I sacrifice my cigarettes. But there are going to be things along the way that we lose. We didn't plan to. We didn't want to. We're going to have to either make our peace with it or go back to where we were before.
Yeah,
that's a hard thing for people to swallow.
It's very hard.
And that itself gets to, again, like, who do we think we are? Right. And it's not saying there are some things that are untouchable. Right. For me, I mean, I would not be willing to lose my marriage. I mostly would not be willing to lose the roof over my head. It would have to be pretty special for me to be willing to lose that.
Right.
But I've gone close to that before as a young man. So mm-hmm. that's not completely off the table, but we have our non-negotiables, right. And then we have the things that we think are non-negotiable. A lot of that is image and reputation. And sometimes even certain relationships that we hang on to because we think they make us better, right? A toxic family relationship that we hang on to because we have this image of ourselves as being the good son or daughter or the good sibling or whatever. But we have to get to that elite level. You have to be willing to look at just about everything.
Forever. Can't leave anything, nothing under the rock.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mike, you talked about communication. And a lot of people think that communication is when we talk to others. Mm-hmm. But the real communication is with ourselves. And that is the deepest type of communication. We need to get better at that. We need to understand how to communicate with ourselves. Because it's not just self-talk. That's okay. But it's that deeper, fundamental talk that we have to have. And you talked about it. Right. We have to leave nothing unturned. We have to go dive deep and we have to be honest and truthful. And you talked about being truthful. That's the communication that a lot of people, they don't do.
No.
And that's something that once you start doing that, once you understand the depths that you can go into to communicate with yourself, then once you can do that, I think understanding other people will just, it's like the heavens will light up because it's understanding yourself first, right? And understanding where you're coming from, where you are, and where you're going is going to be the key ingredients for you to be able to really understand other people. And a lot of that communication has to be with forgiveness for your mistakes, for your triumphs. You know, sometimes you have to forgive yourself because maybe your triumph hurt someone else. So sometimes we look like, yeah, look what I got. But when we really reflect, it's like, I got this because I put that person down. So that's the really deep, deep communication that a lot of people are not willing. I'm successful because, oh, wait a minute, I stepped all over these people to become successful. Let me reframe and let me really, like I said, you talked about communication and to me, it goes deeper, so deep. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah. And thank you for fleshing that out. That's really a tight way of saying it.
What do you do with someone who comes to you and they start doing well mm-hmm. and then boom, they hit the ceiling, but you know,
they hit their plateau.
You know, that's not where they need to go because above that ceiling, there's many floors above.
Yeah.
They may be stopped at the second or third floor. Meanwhile, it's a high story building, right? How do you help someone when they know that you've helped them and they figured, oh, I got it from here. And then boom.
The question in that instance that I really want to the answer to is this a performance issue? Get clear on it could be related to their performance, how well they are doing what they do. Right. And we throw around the phrase now self-sabotage. I don't necessarily think of it as self-sabotage because sabotage is very intentional, intended to stop something from happening. I think of it as a counter-commitment that are, you know, we think of the idea of competing commitments. Well, here's the counter-commitment is that I, on the one hand, I want to perform well and I want to do all these things. And on the other hand, maybe I'm committed to my own boredom. I don't even realize it, but I'm deeply committed on a subconscious level to my own boredom and doing all the activities that numb that boredom in favor of doing what I really want to do. So I want to get really clear on whether this is performance issue or a commitment issue. And then play it from there. See what needs to shift from there. And I have that happen frequently with my clients. My clients typically work with me for a year or more. And there's no chance that in that period of time, they're not going to hit a plateau, that they're not going to struggle. So we're answering this question frequently. And the truth is probably about 2/3 of the time, it is a commitment issue. It is that competing, deeply subconscious commitment that we haven't even examined. We haven't had anyone there to point it out to us that, hey, you say you want this and here's the behavior. Let's talk about the root of that behavior. Let's get real honest about where that's coming from. That might happen on an arc. That discovery might happen over the course of a few sessions where we discover it, we unearth it, and then we work with the nuances and all the little ripples of it before we discern exactly what's happening there and how to remedy it.
How do you help someone also? Thank you for that. That was great. How do you help someone who wears so many different hats, right? Understand their place for themselves when they are at work, when they're with family, or when they're with friends, because everybody acts differently. So where is that balance there? How do you act at work? How do you act with your family? How do you act with friendship with your peers? Depends on circumstances, situations, environment, all these things. But how do you help someone understand how they should?
One of the tools I love to play with working with someone who's struggling with that is the alter ego. And we start with who they are at their state of relaxation, which I will insinuate here that would be how they are with family, with friends, and probably for some of their work. That's a baseline. And if it's not, we start working toward that to create a state of more frequent relaxation. And from there, we acknowledge the need for the alter ego, for a wrinkle in the personality or the wrinkle in the behavior that allows us to be effective in certain situations.
I like that, effective. talk to us about that.
Superman is Superman all the time. All
right.
The alter ego is Clark Kent, and Clark Kent is incredibly useful. Like Clark Kent is not useful when Superman's chilling out in his apartment. He doesn't have to be Clark Kent. Clark Kent has to be himself, or I should say Superman has to be Clark Kent in a few different places, wherever he is with Lois Lane and at the Daily Planet. The rest of the time would be Superman. And we need to explore that in ourselves, where we're going to be our most honest self. And then where we're gonna tweak for effectiveness.
So it's understanding the facade, I guess, right?
Yeah, and understanding that we might want to say that's not the real us. We can act it out, so it is. So it's
part of who we are.
Yeah, it's just a part of us that we let lie dormant a lot.
I think that for me, it's important that anyone that I impact is they find joy in everything they do, in everything, whether it's with your family, your friends, at work. Listen, if you don't find joy in your business, you're in the wrong business. You're absolutely in the wrong business.
Better believe.
You need to find joy because, like, guess what? On your tombstone, they're not going to put, yep, he was great at work. No. Yep, he made sure he finished that report. No.
Nobody's saying that at your eulogy.
Nobody's going to say, oh yeah, he used to come in on time and, work late and, extra. And no, nobody's saying that.
Uh-oh. So
where do you find joy? And if you don't find joy, how can you find joy? Right. So to me, joy is because we are on this earth for a reason. Find your reason. Find your purpose. Pursue it. If you have family, make them part of your joy. If you don't enjoy your family, then maybe you do have to step back a little bit and understand why not.
Yes.
Sometimes we don't choose who we're born to. There was a comment the other day about in this life and the other. And I said, well, that doesn't fit me, but I hope in my next life, I find these type of parents. It was kind of joking, but we don't choose who we're born to or how we grew up, right? Those are choices we don't have. But we do have choices once we're old enough to decide on what kind of a career do I want? What kind of people do I want to be around? Who do I want to have in my inner circle? Because everyone, and it does not matter what your status in life is, has an inner circle. If you're a hermit living in a mountain, you have an inner circle, right? You have you, and you have those animals around you, right? Even a gang leader in jail has an inner circle. Everyone has an inner circle. So you have to decide, who do I want? Who do I allow in? And who do I allow to influence? And like you said earlier in our conversation, it's those people that we surround ourselves that are going to impact, going to make us either better or amazing. Because I don't want to be around anybody who's going to pull me down. You know, if I have to be around them, that's fine. I'll let them have their say and sure, you know, great. And then, of course, I'm not going to pay any attention to that. But I want to be around people who are going to make me better or even great. That's the really people that I really want to surround myself. Thoughts?
Indeed.
Yeah. Mike, how do you help someone who is transitioning from, say, a regular job and they want to do what you do? They want to help you. How can you help someone?
How can I help someone do that? Well, I think the first thing I want to look at is, what is it that they want to create out of it? What kind of change in their lives are they looking to create by making this career shift? I've had clients who have done that, who have gone from being an executive or an entrepreneur into being a coach. And then what they found out was that they love helping other people and they wanted to find a different way to do it. Mm-hmm. And then supported them in doing that. So the first thing we want to look at is, what is it that they really want to create from it? What part of their own expertise, understanding of the world, do they want to tap into and deliver to people? How did they work well? Because being a coach, as you know, involves being in conversation with people a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And not all of us are energized by that. So it's getting to the truth of how they want to deliver that support for the world, how they want to help people, and then create it from there, develop it from there.
Nice.
I've had and oftentimes what ends up happening is they will do something that is not coaching, but they will incorporate coaching skills into it. I have a client who recently, about a year ago, shifted from the corporate world into data consultancy. And that data consultancy is about as nuts and boltsy as it sounds,
right?
You're sitting, you're manipulating data, you're creating systems around it. But the unspoken part of that work is having complicated conversations with people at these companies who we're doing the work for.
Right.
Hey, this is an okay solution, but your process around it needs to change. And oftentimes it includes coaching the people who own that process into making that change. So it's oftentimes it ends up being not just a straight line to coaching, but a yes and. Yes, I want to help people, and here's this wrinkle to it. Here's this expertise that I want to bring that's different from coaching, but we're still going to deliver that support.
I had such a great time talking to you today. I really, really appreciate your time. How can someone find you? Because they're like, you know, I like this guy, Mike. I like everything he said, and I need to have him give me a hand because it sounds to me like he cares and he's genuine and I can be honest with him and he's going to be honest back with him. How can someone reach you, Mike?
Thank you. This was a treat for me as well, Raphael. The best way for someone to find me is my website, mikefharris.com. M-I-K-E-F as in Francis, Harris.com. I respond to every message I get through my website. You can also find me on all the socials, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, even Twitter. I don't tweet, but you can find me on there. Yeah. And I'll share all those with everyone so they can just one click and find me.
Perfect.
And I respond to every message. So by all means, feel free to reach out.
Excellent. And I think they should. Good. Mike, thank you so much for today. It was a pleasure. And I look forward to a long relationship with you because I think we're very like-minded, you and I can tell.
Yes, we are, my friend, like two peas in a pod.
That's it. So I, you know, one day we need to have a big reunion.
I'm up for a round two, my friend. Whenever you're ready, you say the word.
Perfect. Thank you. All right. You have a blessed day.
Hey, you too, my man. Take care.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I'll be back with a new episode and a new guest. You can find all episodes of the Coaching Call podcast on Apple, Anchor, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and wherever you listen to podcasts. I ask that you please leave me an honest review. This episode was made possible by listeners like you. If you enjoyed this episode, go ahead and buy me a cup of coffee. Make it a large. I'm trying to keep this episode free of advertisements. Anything you can donate to the cause is greatly appreciated. To donate, go to paypal.me/SifuRafael. Thank you, and I really appreciate your help.